Grandmaster Melly Mel.
And this is Scorpio, Show No Shame.
And I'm Dynamite, the hypest man in the business.
And if you got ears, listen to 90.3 CKUT.
In solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en, a community event taking place on Wednesday, May 12th from 6:30 till 8 p.m. This event will be focused on the call from many Indigenous, climate justice, and student activist groups calling on McGill University to divest from TC Energy, the company that is constructing the Coastal GasLink pipeline on Wet'suwet'en lands without the collective support of the Indigenous nation. This event is supported by Divest McGill, McGill Nurses for Planetary Health, the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, the Indigenous Student Alliance, and is co-organized with Wet'suwet'en climate justice activist Marlene Hale. Join us on Wednesday, May 12th from 6:30 till 8 p.m. Visit divestmcgill.com. This event is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
The XXXXXXX Files. Exploring feminism and technology through space and time. Good morning. You are listening to the XX Files on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is Wednesday, January 24th, 11:32 in the morning. It's virtually cold outside. And Jules Zagul, your in-studio host, birthday host today. And super excited because in the studio today I have Yulan Stevens with me, cyber feminist researcher who just finished studying at McGill University's Faculty of Law. And Yulan is into thinking about vulnerabilities in media and the law. So she's going to help us understand a little bit about net neutrality, a little bit about the internet, and how to be better cyber feminists. Welcome, Yuan.
Thank you for having me, Jules Zagul, right?
Yeah, happy. Jules Zagul, my honor. Two nicknames stuck together as one.
I love it. Thanks again for having me. And P.S. happy birthday, even though I already said it to you in person, but it's like fun to say it with a microphone on my face.
Oh, I appreciate it. I'll take it coming from any way. So, actually, can I mention how we met?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yuan and I met in the most Montreal way possible, through trading a haircut for a glockenspiel, facilitated by the Montreal Trade Hole Facebook group.
And if I can make it even more Montreal, I got, I was like, oh yeah, and then I can, oh yeah. So we traded this thing over this like trading group, and then I was given a $200 gift certificate where Jules Legault was like cutting hair at the time, because I was a volunteer for Head and Hands, this organization that offers health and legal and social services to youth in Montreal, and that's a really Montreal thing. And then I used this gift certificate and continued to use your amazing hair cutting services, and I continue to this day.
It's a really a beautiful story. And now, and like also like through all of these haircuts, I've been, you know, hearing about Yuan's research and like interests, and I'm like always so fascinated. I was like, we have to have you on the radio. So I'm so glad that it finally worked out.
Cool.
So I don't know. Do you want to maybe start by telling us a little bit about just like the basics of net neutrality and why this is something that we want?
Yeah, I think it's a great question considering we've all been hearing about it in the news for probably a few years, and most definitely in the North American context for the last few months, because we know that the Federal Commission, a communications commission in the U.S., has indeed rolled back net neutrality protection since Trump has come into power. And first of all, yeah, that to, you know, to make this important and to talk about why this matters, of course, the definition is helpful. And so it's a funny term because it was created by Tim Wu, this lawyer working in New York and area. definitely in the U.S., if I might not be correct about the city, but who's actually Canadian. And he coined this term a few years back in a journal-like article. And it's this idea and principle that internet service providers should treat all internet data as the same, regardless of where it comes from, where it's going to, or the content, etc. And the idea is that, you know, you wouldn't be able to access Facebook's, like, in a faster way than you would Google, because we should access it all the same and it shouldn't discriminate against us as users or against the content we access, because there's this notion that the internet should be free, open, to use sort of metaphorical terms for some activists like myself who want the internet to be, you know, uncensored as appropriate and possible. And that's sort of like the basic definition of it.
Okay. So obviously that's important, but how neutral or free or open is the internet that we have now even?
I love this question. I think it's an excellent question. So I was working this past summer as a Berkman Klein Center for Internet Society intern in Boston, and I was writing this like collaborative piece with people, and me and my friend, we were chatting, and we're like, how neutral is the internet in the first place? And he and I sort of had this like social science-y question we wanted to answer, which was like definitely a much larger question than we actually ended up answering in this piece that we wrote. But that is why I love your question. And I mean, I think you can't help but look at the history of the internet when you talk about neutrality and what this even means. One thing I've learned over the, you know, in my years working with Biela Coleman, this professor at McGill, who is like a hacker and internet activist specialist, in a class with her, I learned about the history of the internet, which is actually rooted in the military. And I would seriously question the neutrality of our internet considering its military roots coming after, you know, World War II. And there's this notion as well of the internet being a lawless place. This is like wild, wild west of the internet, which I also think is a sort of image that we need to question. And you can definitely make connections to like issues regarding indigenous rights when you question the sort of like internet as an uninhabited space, just like colonized lands were conceived when we took over them. And then there are still people, you know, who have over the time controlled elements of the internet. So this past summer, as a Berkman Klein intern, I learned from Jonathan Zittrain himself, this person who's like this like world-renowned activist and researcher. He talked to several Berkman Klein interns about the history of a group of people who controlled URL names and like the .coms and .cas. So when there's a group of people who control this and who are gateways, I seriously question whether or not the internet has been neutral and whether elements are ever neutral or will be neutral. So that's a great question.
Okay. So not that neutral
exactly.
Already, but certainly shouldn't be less neutral than it is now.
Exactly, yeah.
And why is this to you a feminist issue? Why does this matter to us as feminists?
I mean, I think, you know, every issue is a feminist issue. The personal is political. Every issue is a feminist issue. I mean, this kind of relates to something I was thinking about in a broader scheme as well. When we talk about any sort of rights and obligations and moral quandaries, ethical and legal quandaries, we can't help but, I think, talk about the most vulnerable in society. And I know that there's like a disempowering element to saying that women are vulnerable, but there's also the fact that we have been marginalized and systemically oppressed throughout society. So in that light, women are just one of many groups of people who are affected by these policies, by or lack thereof, or any of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Cool. The people who are making the decisions right now about the internet are largely like white men, so a lot of other values just aren't really being taken into consideration, and so obviously that has repercussions for the most vulnerable mm-hmm. population.
Yeah, and I was actually talking to someone recently about this notion that the law can evolve to help people. And my partner was recently telling me about like this U.S. Supreme Court case where the law changed in the U.S. regarding racial discrimination to require a standard of reasonableness for whether or not a police person was using excessive force. And then the standard was like lauded as this like great thing and helped that specific case. But then the question is like, if the people in power are deciding what's reasonable and are white old men, then you can question whether or not this reasonable standard is ever going to be applied, such as to consider, you know, to consider the rights of those people who the law is supposed to protect, including women, et cetera, right. and trans and non-binary people, et cetera, et cetera.
Like reasonable by whose standards, mm-hmm. essentially?
That's the question.
Okay. So, what would a repeal to net neutrality mean for Canadians? We hear so much about this in relation to the States, and I think a lot of the like big content that we consume on the internet is owned by Americans anyways. Mm-hmm. So what would this mean for us as Canadians?
Yeah, another great question. And I was looking into this, and as I think we all probably should, and Laura Tribe, who works at Open Media, was actually talking to the CBC just about a month ago about this, and she has some really worthwhile thoughts on this. And I was so drawing on her and other people. You know, she's talked about how what this seems like it'll mean for Canadians is that the costs will go up for the internet. And we're a very expensive country, one of the most expensive in terms of telecom
totally.
Services. And that there would be potential censorship of certain content, which is definitely worrisome. And that, she cited problems like that there would be cable internet packages that would be similar to TV internet packages where you can only access certain websites, for example, because right now, you can only access certain like HBO if you buy into it and that kind of thing. And then she says like one of the other effects is that there would be particular benefit to certain telecom companies, which I think is probably going to only result like, and that relates to the monopolization of services. And then lastly but not least importantly at all is this idea that net neutrality repeals in the U.S. seem like they'll particularly have significant ramifications for poor people, I think, considering things would be more expensive, and that political dissidents of all kinds, whether you're an Indigenous rights activist or you're a feminist or you're a person working for the rights of sex workers or et cetera, will be, harmed by these rollbacks. Potentially, mm-hmm. because they would need access to certain content and might not be able to access it, or would be able to access it at a slower rate, and that's really honestly kind of frightening.
Cool. Okay, so you work with human rights, so is the internet is it something that's becoming a basic human right? Like, is it okay? We're like, we should be able to access whatever we want. Obviously, some of us pay for the internet. Some of us can access that on these devices that we purchase. Like, some people just don't have access to the internet at all. So is, like, in your opinion or in the opinion of the law, either way, is the, is the internet a human right?
Yeah, another good question. There's a lot of digital ink that's been spilled over this. My first gut reaction is that it's more of a, probably right now, an ethical issue than a legal issue. Because the internet is kind of like having a TV. You know, access to the internet seems to me like this interactive conduit for so many other things. And it's more than a TV, obviously, but the idea that we should all have the means to access what has become a completely standard means of communication and means of experiencing the world seems to me to be totally, very hard to argue with. Like, how can you say that a person shouldn't have access to the internet? And then the question is, I don't know if you ever learned about Free Basics in India, but it's this, this wild program where Facebook tried to offer internet access to people in India, but said, and it was like totally anti-net neutrality, actually, where they end up offering access to Facebook and numerous other apps, and I saw like pictures of this thanks to a person's work from Global Voices, this international organization that, you know, helps people write about like pressing internet issues. And I learned about how Free Basics actually ended up prioritizing Facebook access, and of course they surveilled you, and then certain apps, of course, related to the Facebook conglomerate, and then was supposed to offer internet access. So I think, you know, does everyone deserve the right to the internet? Yes, but it shouldn't come at any cost where a person only has access to that in a way where they are indebted to one company. Now, I think we need, this is, I'm not talking as an expert, but more just as a citizen. And I think we do need like all kinds of competition, all kinds of rights in our favor, which is why organizations like the CRTC, that's one of our organizations in Canada that we can actually make claims to. The Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission, which actually like presides over internet access for us, like TV, radio, and these regulatory bodies have sort of dull but very important jobs, I think. That's just one sort of long-winded answer to the question, and I think it's a complex question, you know?
Yeah. Well, like, it seems like it's clear. It's like, should be more open and more neutral and not less. But, I mean, I obviously have different stakes than other people do, so.
Yeah, and what's your take on that? Do you think that we should have access to the internet? Is it a right in, like, your perspective?
I think that it's like, well, if there is the infrastructure to have internet pretty much everywhere, which, like, at this point, I think there is. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I'm also not an expert, but yeah, as a citizen, I think if we have the capacity and the infrastructure to have internet everywhere and, you know, and could implement, you know, public use, I think that that's definitely the way that we should be going.
Yeah, it's like everyone having a phone even. And then the internet is one of those things that the phone can, it relies on. It's like, we all, it's like learning how to write, probably. It's like its own kind of literacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I would definitely like to see more people have access to the whole internet.
Yeah.
Not just Facebook.
An unfettered, largely access that protects their privacy, allows them to not be censored, etc.
Right. Because, what I hear a lot is, like, on the internet, if you're not paying for something, like if you're not paying for a service, you are the product. I think that that's the way this saying goes. Yeah. So if you're not paying for something, you're paying for it with your data or with your identity, and people are making money off of you. Mm-hmm. I just like feel like that is such a, like, I don't want that either, you know? Like, can't it just be a public service?
Right. Like,
I mean, maybe it's a utopian idea, but would be nice.
Yeah.
So moving on, I want to talk a little bit about cyberfeminism. So this is a word that's like been being used kind of in different contexts since the early 90s, late 80s. And I wonder, what does cyberfeminism mean to you in 2018?
Yeah, I think it's a cool question. I think that cyberfeminism is an interesting term because it can mean so many different things to different people. And I think, yeah, that's kind of like the nut of, you know, what I think about that probably it's an extension of what it means to you to be a feminist, and then considered in light of your existence in the internet as a real world. I think that finally, just from a sort of everyday life perspective, we are seeing the internet as like a very real part of our reality. Because I think that for a long time, there was a sense that the internet wasn't real, like it was a sort of alternate reality. It was like for jokes and just sort of, you know, like it wasn't real, and like you know, the conversations you'd have weren't part of who you were. But we realize now, especially like millennials, that no, actually the internet isn't, like, let's say, you know, texting, all that, so integral to our lives. Mm-hmm. So I do see that you know, the notion of being a feminist is just saying, like, I recognize that the internet is incredibly important in our lives. And and therefore, you know, when I want to distribute access to resources in an equitable way to women and trans people and non-binary folks, et cetera, and I like the et cetera a lot because it can mean that it includes people who, who aren't just women, for example, or who are not, all kinds of people, that we see that that work and that activism extends to the digital sphere. I can think of numerous people actually whose work inspires me that that I think really embodies this.
Okay.
So I was just thinking about, like, you know, when I was thinking about, as I think about, you know, the work of Mauricia Levesque and Tina Salame. These are people who I've met just in the last few months whose work is super inspiring. They're both Montreal-based currently, and I love their work because they're both artists and people who work in the tech world. And so Mauricia is actually a new grad or somewhat recent grad of McGill's Law Faculty too, but also has a background in interactive arts.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I love that. And then I know Tina has worked in computational arts, but is also a hacker. And so the two of them actually recently offered a workshop, you know, run by Studio XX, and there was another one as well. Actually, the one they ran was at Concordia, and it was a safer sexting workshop. And I think the goal of feminism, you know, one of the goals, there's so many, is to empower, which I, you know, you could debate that word, but like also to like give information to and to access new cracks into like systems that they can access for their gain, because they haven't had, you know, the resources or the ability to. And so like in this workshop, which I couldn't attend, but it was the idea that like you can actually send like nudes and texts like and have like sexy conversations on like your phone and other means and protect your privacy. And that's so key. I was also actually just talking to a friend, Sam Datesman, who I met at Berkman in Boston, and she was telling me she's currently working there, and she was telling me that, you know, she's actually just a high school grad, but she's brilliant, and she's run hackathons where they seek to like make sure that the attendance rate is comparable to the demographics of the U.S. population or like the population of the area they're in, and then they can do all these tiny little things that like make sure that like, if women and other people who are there are learning like technical skills, that they check in far more often than like the hands-off approach, because they know that women, for example, like have been trained not to take up as much space. Mm-hmm. So I think those are examples of like what it means to be a cyber feminist. Just a few.
I love that. No, that's so, it's really helpful for me because I've come from a more like theoretical practice where it's like, okay, this like 1980s, 1990s cyber feminism is really utopic, mm-hmm. and about thinking about like, oh, here's this new thing that we can totally take over and it can be ours. And like, but and it's like, okay, fast forward 2018, like didn't really work out. Hmm. But actually just to acknowledge that like the internet mostly just kind of is a reflection of what's going on in like material life. Yeah. So I think that these like practices of trying to have it accurately and like equitably reproduce kind of like some demographics of real life, but try not to reproduce the oppression. I think that's like, yeah, that is like such a revolution. It's so simple, but it's so revolutionary to just mm-hmm. be like, well, this is just actually an extension of the real world that we live in. So let's just like try our best to make it be like the place that we want it to be and like just not necessarily think about it in this kind of fantasy utopic setting.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So,
and it reminds me of the work of, I know we don't have much time left, but Whitney Phillips has written about trolls. She's a academic in the U.S. and she's like, hey, trolling culture and Gamergate actually just represent things that exist in our culture
totally
at large.
Yeah, I mean, like being like trolled or like being just like harassed in real life or catcalled. It's like, yeah, just these things just kind of take different forms.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Okay, so It is. Yeah, we are running out of time, but I just wonder if find like it's so overwhelmed to feel or it's so easy to feel overwhelmed by the power of the internet and social media and mm-hmm. big data. So do you have any like just like little kind of bite-sized strategies that we can take with us into our everyday lives to try and make our online spaces a little bit safer or more equitable?
Yeah, I definitely thought about this because there was there's like so many Facebook groups for law students, and there was this issue where a person posted a meme and they were making fun of the person who was dragged off a United Airlines plane, and there was this ensuing significant debate, and I took pictures of everything because I was like shocked by how people were talking, both in like defense of this person, but I was also fairly like proud of my fellow colleagues who were challenging this person who like was using this like very recent like awful experience to lousily like relate to people. And I think that was one example and case in point of how I think online spaces, Facebook groups, even Reddit, like subreddits and stuff, like I think the people who run those like, I actually have the obligation to set norms, ideally with a consensus base, which is really difficult with so many people, but at least with input from members. Because for example, there's this one Facebook group, I think it's Queer Housing Montreal or Chez Queer, and in that group like there's like norms that are set up. I think all these small spaces, realizing though it's arduous, need to be regulated mm-hmm. in like a caring and like adaptable way. Otherwise people can just say whatever the fuck they want, and that's really not fair to the people who ought to inform like the norms of that space.
Totally. I always say this, that I like a procedure is a feminist practice.
Ooh, I like that.
And I like people just get so bogged down with administration and whatever, and it's like, no, this is like, yeah, if you have a procedure, then it's easy to have something to follow. And then yeah, people, it's like when things do go awry, you have something to kind of look to and be like, well, This is how this went down. This is how it should have been. And like a way to kind of move forward in a way that seems constructive.
I love that. I just wrote it down.
Oh, great.
That's so good.
And so, okay, yeah, that's a really good one. Just be like, so make practical. Some rules on the internet. And like, yeah, treat these communities as you would if you were in real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when groups who meet in real life come together and just state norms, I do this in group work, which is intense but also really helpful, or if I work in a team, I love when people are say like what they prefer or of all kinds, or like what they need and like are aware of who they are and their like fallibilities or their strengths. Then if we do that both in real life and in online spaces, we won't run into the problems of, well, we will of course, but the idea is to be proactive and, like you said, have those procedures, which actually protect those who otherwise, you know, aren't in power. So,
Cool. It's 11:59, so we're gonna leave it there. Thank you so much, Yuan. If you want to follow Yuan on Twitter, it's just @YuanStevens.
It's my name, but like YSTVNS. You can also just Google me, Yuan Stevens.
Follow for super relevant content.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is underway, but not everybody is protected yet. Even if you've been vaccinated, you still need to respect basic health measures, like wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, and washing your hands regularly. You must also get tested if you have symptoms and follow self-isolation guidelines. Find out about the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Follow all the health guidelines, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The 37th Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoriaville, a must for safe live arts, May 17th to 23rd. Concerts, sound art installations in public spaces, experimental short films, and visual arts. For a safe event of living arts, let's meet in Victo this May. Details and tickets for the 37th FEMAV at www.femav.qc.ca. That's www.femav.qc.ca.
Now I have to talk to the audience. I have to say,
are you talking before you play anything, or are you playing?
Yeah, I'm saying, I say hi, it's EKT, and what's the name of the show? It's called If You Got Ears. Today, medicine.
This is an example of large bowel obstruction in an 82-year-old male patient with a constriction.